building a public is such a powerful thing if you are willing to share unfinished work. That may be the framework that we're looking for here, because building in public is all about sharing the journey.
So hi everyone, welcome back to Business Podcast Brewery. So today we have a treat of an episode with Arvid Kahl. So hi Arvid, so could you quickly and in under 1 minute kind of explain to the audience who you are and what you do?
I'm gonna try. So I'm a software engineer turned entrepreneur turned writer turned audience builder turned educator. I think that's kind of my progression that I went through over the last couple of years. I co-founded a software service company back in 2017, and I sold that with my partner, my life partner, Danielle. We sold that in 2019 for a life-changing amount of money. And ever since then, I've been teaching people about reaching out to their community, finding followers, building SaaS businesses, building audiences, like just figuring out entrepreneurship, solopreneurship, bootstrap entrepreneurship. I'm a writer, I guess. I have a couple books. I made a couple courses. I'm trying to teach people as much as I can from my experience, not just running that one successful business, but also failing many, many others before. And I'm very active on Twitter. I'm in the Twitter audience building space, trying to help people find their people and be kind and helpful and supportive. So that's pretty much what I do. And I guess that's a minute. Wow. I usually take 5 or 6 minutes to explain these things. So this is a first.
I learned this from Arav. Actually, I was just watching his interview just before we had our interview today, and I had learned from him that he did yours under 2 minutes. So I wanted to see if I could do it under one. I didn't know that was possible.
Well, thank you for telling me that there was a time limit. You know, that makes a whole lot of difference.
I've never actually done a time limit before, but I feel that, you know, when it's a succinct thing, maybe like it, we can like segue on into more.
Yeah. Well, one thing that this shows to me is that once you are a creator, once you are in the creator space and you do things for other people, content and knowledge building and knowledge dissemination, there are so many things that you do, right? It's not just I'm doing one thing and that's all I do. No, I have to write, I have to record things, do a podcast and market these things and find sponsors and deal with advertising and deal with the sales and whatnot. Like once you turn a creator, you become a person that does 10 to 20 things at the same time. So it's kind of hard to even condense that into something short. Like when I was a software engineer, you would have asked me, I would have said, I'm a front-end software engineer for an IoT company. And everybody would have understood what that was. And that was my life up to 2017. Maybe 2018 even, because we built Feedback Panda, our SaaS business, on the side for half a year before we even went full-time on the business. So back then, very easy description. But ever since, we sold the business in particular, I've been all over the place. So I guess today we're going to touch on many different topics because there's probably a lot to talk about.
Yeah, today I think it's going to be a true masterclass from your end. And so I wanted to start off with, so in the beginning, you'd kind of mentioned about having a helping mentality. So how did you kind of find your unique voice on Twitter, and how did you actually end up on Twitter?
Oh, that's interesting. So I found the indie hacker software entrepreneur community initially on indiehackers.com, which is the forum, right, where a lot of indie hackers hang out. And then through that forum, I found the Twitter community, mostly by following the same people that I found interesting in the founder community, all those founders that were on podcasts and that were sharing the knowledge in the forums, on their blogs and on YouTube. I found those people on Twitter, and then I figured out, oh, wow, this is actually an extremely supportive community. Because before that, I was using Twitter as most people do. I was lurking and talking about whatever, right? Reading about whatever, following a couple celebrities here, a couple people that I knew there. And it was just a social network, just like Facebook is. But once I found this entrepreneurial community, I found, oh, wow, this is a place where people are extremely supportive of each other. There's no vitriolic hate speech or anything like it in this community. It's not politics Twitter. It's indie hacker Twitter. It's a very different space. And I wanted to be part of it. And after we sold the business, I all of a sudden I had time to spend time in the community. Before that, when we built the business, and before, I was always too busy actually like living my life as a software engineer to think that I might be part of a community and I should contribute to that. I was always just taking in, right? I was always just reading and learning and listening, but never shared what I did or what I learned. And when we sold the company, I had learned that through the course of building this business, that my passion is not building software. My passion is helping people do the things that they wanted to do. Software was just a conduit for that. Like writing the source code for Feedback Panda, that was fun. But seeing people actually make more money because of it, that was way more interesting. So helping and understanding the supportive nature of what I can do, that was all of a sudden something that I wanted to keep doing. I didn't want to keep building software, really. I didn't care as much about that as I cared about trying to help more people. And Twitter is an amazing medium to do this. Like if you go on Twitter and you become part of a community that is very supportive and shares each other's work, you can very quickly reach hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of people. Like at this point, I have a couple million of tweet impressions per month on Twitter. That means that out of these millions of impressions, probably a couple hundred thousand of people actually read what I'm saying. And that is mind-blowing to me, that with what I have to say, what I want to share with people gets read by so many people just because I type it into one box on the internet. It's just, it's scale that is incomprehensible almost for human beings. But we get to do this when we build an audience. And that's kind of what I'm trying to teach people, right? To use this medium as a medium for good, for progress, for empowerment. And I found all of this in building my own business, understanding that empowerment comes through action, doing something to help other people. You help them, they become better at what they do, and eventually they will help you back. There will be some kind of reciprocation. But that's kind of what most people think of the most, like making money, right? Turning this into like monetizing it and just like monetizing your audience. But that is almost a side effect of being kind and empowering to people. And that's kind of my mission. That's kind of what I teach.
That's an amazing mission that you have behind you of being this like kindness. And I've always seen you on Twitter and you're always so kind and so helpful to everybody. And I think that you really embody your mission and your values. And so my next question is, so as you have gained more followers, so this is from Rohan Barnabas. So how has your Twitter content kind of evolved? Any advice for some of the newbies out there on Twitter?
Yeah. So one thing that I noticed is that when I post something today, I get quite a lot of engagement because I have a lot of followers and I have a lot of followers that care about what I have to say. But 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago at this point, I guess, when I had 400 followers and not 70,000 as I have now, whenever I would post something, nobody cared. And that's not just because nobody wanted to see what I wrote. It's because nobody saw what I wrote, right? If you have a couple hundred followers and you write a tweet, then only a fraction of your, like my example, 400 followers, maybe just 50 of them would actually see what I wrote in the timeline, because I'm not the only person they follow. There's a lot of other stuff that ranks higher than me, particularly when I have just 400 followers. So when I would write things, nobody would read them, nobody would engage. And I would be sad because I thought nobody cared. But obviously, it wasn't that nobody cared. It was nobody could even care about it because nobody saw it. So when you're starting out on Twitter, one of the things that I see be way more effective than starting to tweet all your many, many thoughts is to engage with people somewhere else where they're already having a conversation, where there's already people watching. That's kind of the idea, right? It's like when you go to a party, you don't just walk into the middle of the room and start shouting. Nobody does that. I mean, some people do it, but they're probably very drunk. You know, it's probably not the right people to follow. But when you want to have an impact on the conversation at a party, you join the group of people that are already chatting. You stand there, you listen to what they are talking about, and then if you have something meaningful to say, you start contributing. And all of a sudden, you're part of a conversation. And you're part of a conversation with a lot of people because there's a group of 10 people standing around you, and now 9 of them are looking at you. Right? That is the idea on Twitter. You don't just walk into the middle of the room and yell. You don't shout. You go to where people are chatting and you engage with them. That means if you're starting out on Twitter, you won't be tweeting much by yourself, most of the things that you should be doing is just engagement, going into conversation, replying, or retweeting with a quote tweet, or inviting somebody else into the conversation. Anything that is a contribution to the existing conversation is going to be much better than your thoughts on whatever topic you may have in the beginning. And over time, this behavior attracts people that find you interesting because you're nice. They find you interesting because you're smart, because you are a contributor, because you are more interested in contributing to another person's conversation than starting your own. And this, like at a party, attracts people to you because you're not selfish, you're selfless, you're helping, supportive. And that behavior will then grow your own following, and then those people will want to hear from you. So over time, you will ramp up your own content, your own thoughts, and you mix it with the engagement that you already do, because that is just a nice thing, a nice way to find new people to follow for you and to follow you. So that ratio shifts over time. But I have seen a lot of success with just focus, so almost a 100% focus on engagement and barely any tweeting in the beginning, and then shifting it towards more of an equilibrium, kind of a balance, like a 50-50 or a 60-40, whatever you want to do between engagement and content. But that is kind of, yeah, that would be the one thing, the most important thing on Twitter as a platform. And I think that is also true for any other platform, LinkedIn or Facebook or whatnot. If you go to where people are already having a nice, friendly conversation and you are equally nice and friendly, you're going to be part of the pack much quicker than if you try to attract people out of nowhere.
I think that was a very powerful point. And those last three points on contributing, being selfless, and responding where the conversation is happening is amazing. And I think you perfectly embody that, because you have 60,000 followers, but yet you still are always interacting with your audience, you're always retweeting, you're always sharing, and you're always having such a kind voice. And just, I think that's kind of a secret sauce to your growth.
Yeah, I agree. And I do this consciously and intentionally, because first off, I like the people that I follow. And I follow a lot of people, but there are a lot of founders out there building a lot of interesting things. There's a lot of really interesting creators making really, really meaningful stuff. And all of these people deserve to be followed. And that's why I follow, 13,000 people at this point? That's a lot, but it's also a lot of good stuff. Because the Twitter algorithm, as weird as it may be, and as hard as it may be to predict and understand, it does surface the most interesting things depending on who you follow. And if you follow the right people, and maybe the most important part, if you don't follow the wrong people, you get to see the interesting and community-centric content. And that's what I see. Like when I open my Twitter feed first thing in the morning, I see 5-10 conversations about people helping each other, or somebody having success and other people celebrating them, or somebody seeing failure and other people consoling them, helping them. That's what I see in my Twitter feed, because I exclusively follow people who would write that. I don't follow people who wouldn't. So that makes it very easy for me to engage with these things, because those are the things that I want to see to begin with. And maybe more on the business side of things, like I have a media business, right? I wrote books, I sell books. I created courses, I sell courses. I have a blog that has a newsletter, that has sponsors. That's how I monetize the whole thing. There is advertisement and product sales. So to do this, to be able to do this, I have to come up with interesting things that people want me to tell them, because they themselves don't have the time to find them, or they don't have the resources or the expertise, and they just want somebody else who has some sort of knowledge to tell them what it is. And for that, I need to understand what's going on in the community, right? And for that, I want to be part of the community, because otherwise I wouldn't know. So it's kind of a almost a business self-preservation thing for me to be part of this, because that's where I get my weekly writing ideas, my weekly podcast, my newsletter, and my YouTube things. They all come from within the community, because you can be quite sure if somebody talks about a topic and a lot of people start talking about it, a couple weeks from now, or maybe this week, I will voice my opinion about this in some way, because I know people are already, it's validation. It's like with any business, right? You want to validate that there's a problem. You want to validate that your solution is good. You want to validate that there's enough people to pay for it. It's the same with content. As a creator, you want to validate that it's interesting to people, that there's enough people that this might actually resonate with, and that the thing you talk about has some meaningful way of contributing to the ongoing conversation. So that's kind of how I see my own engagement with the community. It's not just because I'm a nice person. I hope that I am, and I hope that it is reflected in what I do, but it's also the way that I keep engaging with the meta discussions and all the topics of conversations in the community, because quite frankly, I find them interesting and I want to contribute to them.
That's amazing. And I think the biggest takeaways for the audience today are to have a curated following and engage with meta discussions. So Bob De Pascal asks you, so you had mentioned previously about your book, Zero to Sold, and a couple of other ways that you monetize. So what was your favorite book or favorite product that you created?
Yeah. Wow, that's like choosing your favorite child. But I think Zero to Sold in some way is the very first thing I ever did as a creator, right? I mean, I started a blog, which was cool, and it was fun to write on a weekly basis, but I never thought I was a writer. I just thought I was a guy who blogged at that point, right? Before I started writing the book. And the way Zero to Sold happened was I wrote several blog posts. There must have been dozens at that point. I started writing on my blog in November 2019. And somewhere around January, a couple months later, people told me, hey, all the things you wrote, they are really cool. But I see that there's a structure to this. This could be a book. And I was like, yeah, it could be a book. I never thought about this. And then I started writing the other chapters for the book that I saw it should be. And that is what the book turned into. Like, I didn't set out to write a book. I just set out to blog every week to keep myself accountable and to do something after selling the business, because we both, like Danielle and I, we both fell into a void after we sold the business. All the meaning that we had, all the joy and passion that we had in helping these online teachers with our software as a service business, that was not done by somebody else. And we had no more way of finding our passion in our work because we had no business anymore. So we fell into this, what am I going to do kind of situation? And I quickly started writing. And that kept me going. So I started the blog out of coping with not having anything to do. And the fact that that turned into a book that is now so distributed all over the world. People recommend this to their peers. They recommend it to their colleagues. It's mind blowing. I think I recently checked on Amazon where I sell this through their Amazon KDP self-publishing arm. I think I sold almost 7,000 copies of Zero to Sold on Amazon alone. And then there's the audiobook, and then there's Gumroad, where I also offered as a PDF or EPUB or whatever, right? Because I want to enable people to buy the book in whatever shape or form. And some people don't have Amazon because they don't live in one of the 8 countries that Amazon supports, which is also weird. You know, the fact that there's, with all of this, like 10,000 people that bought my product that I didn't even set out to write, but had the knowledge to do and now find the feedback and resonance so strongly positive. That is probably one of the most elevating moments of my life. Because I'm German, right? English is my second language. So writing a book in a second language that people don't hate already feels like an incredible accomplishment to me, you know, because so many people try and barely anybody ever sells a copy. What's the saying? Like the median number of sales for any book is like 100. Like that's like the middle. That's the average or median, I guess. That is substantial to know that I have sold 100 times that. Is bizarre. And then there's the other book, and then there's the courses, all kind of interact with each other because it's all about similar topics or different perspectives on similar topics. But Zero to Sold was the first thing where I ever felt, okay, I'm not just a software engineer. This is not the box that fully encapsulates me. I should be in multiple boxes, or maybe I shouldn't be in any boxes at all. Maybe I'm not just an engineer or a creator or anything. Maybe I'm just a person that also likes software engineering and creation and writing and entrepreneurship. It kind of that opened up not just opportunities for me, but also my own self-perception leveled up into this, okay, I'm more than just one thing. And from that allowed me to understand, okay, then I can be anything I want. If I want to be a YouTuber as well, I just need to point a camera at my face. That's all I need to do. I don't need to go to YouTube University. I could just start, right? So that's kind of how what the book did for me. It's a greeting card. It's a collection of what I know, but it's also the thing that showed me that I can be way more than I thought I ever was.
Yeah, I think you had a phenomenal story. And I think I've observed from you, from your book, that you kind of really build this book out in public. And you were very embedded with getting feedback from your audience as well. So could you share any kind of building in public frameworks with the audience today?
Sure. Yeah, with the first book, I essentially wrote it in public because I didn't even know I was writing it. Like the first half of the book was blog posts that were already public. And then I got a lot of feedback on because people started reading my blog and gave me their opinions and gave me opinions about topics that I needed to cover. So that was really helpful. Maybe going back to Zero to Sold, when people told me this should be a book, I immediately turned the existing blog post into a compendium, right? I put a one single page and I said, this is the bootstrapping guide. Here are links to all these different topics. And then here are the other topics that I want to write about. I essentially built an outline for the whole book in public and gave it away for free. It's just that half of the book was in there. The other half wasn't yet written. So that was Zero to Sold, the first book. For the second book that I wrote, The Embedded Entrepreneur, which is kind of a zooming into the first part of building a business, like where's my business idea coming from? Who am I going to be serving? And what problems do they have? How can I figure this out? And then how can I build an audience around that? That's what the book is about. For that, I really went super public. Like I put out a tweet. I said, I want to write a second book. This is the topic that I want to build this whole book around. Here is my initial outline. Now tell me what you think. And at that point, my audience was like 4,000 people. I got a lot of people telling me what they thought I should do, which was great because I ignored most of it. But a lot of things in there were really, really helpful for me to structure a better book that was pragmatic and even more actionable than Zero to Sold. I tried to make Zero to Sold very actionable because that's kind of how I approach doing anything. I'm a self-taught coder, entrepreneur, writer. I learn things by figuring them out. So anything actionable will help me immediately. I translated that into my work as well. But for that book, I went all the way. And once I had a draft, I wrote the first draft, I think within a month, must have been January 2020. Was it 2020? I forgot. Could have been, was it 21? You know, time flies. But I wrote it within a month. It was 21. And I immediately gave the book, the draft, to, I think, 200 beta readers. I had an email list signed up ready for people who wanted to read the beta version, the draft of my book, and give me comments. And I sent that version out to 200 people. And over the next couple of weeks, I took what they told me, all the feedback with, oh, this passage is unreadable, and this is a repetition of what you said earlier, and I need a better explanation for this here, turned all of this into more drafts that I invited people like 50 a block into the new drafts until I had over 500 people reading the beta version of The Embedded Entrepreneur. And at that point, it was good enough that not many people complained about anything. And that was over like 2 months' time, I think. And in April, I gave the book to a professional editor and a professional proofreader, and they went through it and fixed all the little mistakes that the public non-professional editors hadn't found at that point, gave them back the full version, and I immediately released it to my community. That's kind of how building in public worked for the second book. And it was an awesome process. Like the book had great resonance because obviously the people who needed to read it had already read it and now told me how to make it even better. And I feel this can be done for any product. And I did the same for my Twitter course for Find Your Following because I shared little tidbits of what I was working on and took even while I was writing the script for this course, which is a 4.5 hour course, which is itself 42,000 words, could be a book. And I probably should just turn it into one at some point because why not, right? While I was doing this, I was taking parts of the script and I just released them as blog posts. And then people gave me feedback on parts of my unreleased Twitter course that I hadn't even recorded yet that I could work back into the course. Building a public is such a powerful thing if you are willing to share unfinished work. That may be the framework that we're looking for here, because building in public is all about sharing the journey and not the goal, right? The goal for me was to teach people about embedded entrepreneurship, about the idea of going into a community and figuring out people's problems and solving them with the community and then turning that into products. But I didn't sell the goal. I am kind of embarked on a journey and invited people to follow me. And that created a lot of feedback cycles. Like I said, I got a lot of really good feedback on the product itself, but it also created interest in the product and people talking to other people about a product that wasn't even done yet, but they knew about it because I was sharing updates and I was sharing like little steps and experiments that I did along the way. The same with the course. I was sharing little video outtakes of my recording process and how I learned how to record, because I have never in my life ever talked into a teleprompter before. And I did that for the course, and I shared with people how I did that, how I set it up, and how hard it was, and how hard it is to light a studio, to even build a studio. And, you know, all these little things I just shared on a daily basis. And then it was unsurprising that when I launched the course, I think it made $15,000 within the first month, because there was just everybody who was kind of along for the ride was interested in the product because they had been part of it. They'd contributed to the overall conversation around the product. So I was ready from the beginning to share whatever I experienced, which is the number one thing you need to know about building in public. No matter if it's great, a success, a horrible failure, a tiny learning, which sometimes you just learn about a particular shortcut in a particular tool. Like, oh, I didn't know that I could take a screenshot of a part of a window with like shift command 3 or something. That may be super boring, but if you share this in the context of building things, then all of a sudden you're teaching. You're not just talking about your product. You're teaching other people how to do their own stuff. And even if it's the most minute, boring thing, it still is valuable to the people that follow you along your journey. So being willing to go there and share anything, all the little things, that creates this constant narrative, this ongoing exploration of your journey that people are super involved in because they invest in it. They invest their interest, they invest their time and their energy and the hope that it becomes a great product, and they will help you make it happen. They will give you feedback to make it even better. So that's my long-winded version of a building in public framework, because it's all about involving people, making them feel heard, giving them the opportunity to invest in you and your journey, and then receiving something meaningful back from their contribution to your journey, because you share what you know and they will make sure that it's the best it can be.
Stressed the importance of community building throughout this episode, as well as you've also stressed the importance and the amazing power that Twitter has. So my last question to you is more along the lines of Feedback Panda, which you had discussed in your introduction. So question to you is, so if you started Feedback Panda again, would you take VC money or would you just bootstrap it? And what's your take on founders looking to raise VC money in a somewhat market condition that isn't very promising?
Yes. Wow. What a question. It's always kind of, it's easy to connect the dots in retrospect, right? When I look back at my journey with Feedback Panda, I look at it and I say, oh, apparently we've done everything right. We were there at the right time, the right market, with the right product, with the right go-to-market approach, with the right marketing approach, with the right community approach, with the right product capabilities. And we sold it just at the right time for us because it was a life-changing amount of money. Right? It changed our lives forever. We're financially independent, which we definitely weren't before. And we can now use both the financial outcome and the reputational outcome of building this business for whatever we want to do. So honestly, looking back at it, I would just bootstrap again because we owned the business. And I think that allowed us to make a couple choices that having VC money in the business would not have allowed us, because we could just stick with our niche and be happy with a business that had made only, scare quotes, $55,000 a month with 2 employees, which was me and Danielle. We had no other employees. So after taxes and after all the expenses, that still leaves us with a solid 5-figure monthly income for 2 people, right? That was good enough. Like, I didn't need more money. That was already great. And I owned the whole thing. Like, we both owned 50% of that business. Nobody else could tell us what to do. It was completely our choices to make and our strategies to come up with for how we would expand or not expand the business. Now, I've worked for and within VC-funded businesses before. So I know the pressures that money can put on a business, right? Because if you have to fulfill your obligations to shareholders and investors, then all of a sudden your choices as the owner or as the leader of the business, if you're just a CEO, but you don't own the business, all of a sudden they're not aligned with your own personal financial stability goals anymore. They're aligned with the financial gains goals of your investors. And for us at Feedback Panda, that probably would have meant a couple things. We probably would have expanded into different markets because we would have needed to de-risk the business by going out of the Chinese educational market into the Malaysian or the Japanese educational market or into the American educational or Indian educational market. There would have been a lot of pressure for us to go sideways and up and down, right? To figure out where are the other markets that our product can serve. With the bootstrapping approach, we didn't really have to do it. We found a really nice niche. We put ourselves in there. We got most of that market share, really, because we were at the right time in the beginning, and there wasn't any meaningful competition because we had a really great product and nobody wanted to clone it for some reason, which was great. But you know, if you have other people that have like these hockey stick growth expectations, because VC money is this, right? You need to, your business needs to make money for 100 other businesses that fail. That is not what Feedback Panda, I would have not wanted Feedback Panda to be this for other businesses, because we would have needed to turn it into something that it wasn't supposed to be. So no, I probably would not want VC money. I would bootstrap. However, and we're talking about economic downturns and recessions and taking money, obviously it's always better not to use your own money when there's risky times ahead, right? That's kind of why people like the VC model, because they can just get risk capital that people already think is probably not going to come back to them. So for that, I guess I can understand why people would want VC money. But with that money, and that's why I say this, comes the expectation of you trying to do as much as you can to 100x, 1000x, 50,000x that amount of money. So particularly now, going into a recession or going into a situation where it's unclear if consumer behavior is still going to be the same next year as it is today, maybe that risk is more risk than you're actually willing to take. And of course, this is neither financial nor investment advice, because everybody has to make their own choices here. But I personally would try to stay away from VC money as much as I could. Bootstrapping is still an option. And one thing that many people don't even have on their radar, there are bootstrapper-aligned funding options out there. Right? It's not that you need to raise VC money to get funding. There are many companies, many funds out there that are focused on bootstrap businesses because they understand we don't need to give them millions and millions of dollars. We just need to make it easier for them to hire their first couple employees or to do the marketing push into this market to establish themselves as a niche player. And that could be $50,000, $250,000. Doesn't need to be $20 million. There doesn't even need to be a round, right? You don't need to raise a seed and then an A, a B, C, D. It doesn't need to happen. You just might need that one push, and then your business might just grow sustainably and calmly over time. And at this point, I guess I have to mention that I am a limited partner in the Calm Company Fund, which is a fund that does this. I just want to make it clear that I'm invested in this. But there's companies like Tiny Seed out there that are an accelerator for bootstrap businesses. Or there's many other small VCs, right? These kind of niche VCs that don't have the venture capital Uber or Airbnb style business in mind. They want a portfolio of many small bootstrap businesses, and then they finance them with small cash injections, and many of them don't even take equity. They just have this kind of income or revenue sharing agreement. There are many ways that are not necessarily VC money. I know I'm kind of droning on about this now, but I just want to make sure that, because in some countries, and Germany is one of them where I'm from originally, and India is one of them too, many people perceive startups to be either VC funded or they're really bad. There's only these two extremes, right? Like bootstrapping, not a good idea. Don't put your money in there. Get somebody else's money. That's a lot of that thinking still. In the States and Canada, it's different. People start to understand that bootstrapping is a veritable way of building a business, and you don't have to build the world's biggest business to be successful. That is now coming more into the social focus. But in some countries, the old way is still like a lot of money or no money at all. So trying to make sure that people understand that bootstrapping is a viable way, and there are means to, you know, get started without having to take massive amounts of cash.
Perspective, and I love your take on why you will still continue to bootstrap versus get VC money. That was, and also your ending point on resources as well for bootstrappers out there to at looking at alternative VC funding methods, which aren't exactly VC funding. Awesome. Thanks very much for the discussion today. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.